Staying Alive UK. Share your story.
Hello and welcome to the Share Your Story podcast series, a business biography, their story so far. I'm Michael De Groot and I'm your host. My purpose through this podcast series is to inspire you to take the next step towards your new business venture or indeed develop your existing business even further. I only interview business owners who employ less than 9 employees, and mostly they will be on their own. So let's get straight to it. And I'm delighted today to have on the podcast Jamie Shanks. Jamie is one of the world's leading social selling experts. He has personally built social selling solutions in nearly every industry, ranging from startups to Fortune 500 corporations. Before starting his first sales agency, Jamie was the director of sales at 2 SaaS software companies, Captive Channel Corp and Firmex Inc., building their businesses from infancy to profitability. Jamie is also the author of the book Social Selling Mastery and has delivered keynotes in dozens of cities across 6 continents for brands such as Thomson Reuters, Oracle, Direct Energy, Lenovo, and Intel. Welcome to the Share Your Story podcast, Jamie. How are you today?
I'm fantastic. Thank you so much for having me.
And this, you are my first Canadian guest.
Wow. So thank you.
I really, really appreciate your time coming on the podcast today. I'm really looking forward to hearing your story. We've known each other for a while, but I don't think I've heard your story. Obviously, I can read about it. So we're going to kick off with a personal kind of introduction. So why don't you share with our listeners a little bit about your personal life, like where were you born, a bit about your education, and where you now live, and how did you end up where you're living? Maybe about your family, but you don't have to share anything about your family if you don't wish to. Your hobbies and interests, just so that people get a little bit of a view about the personal Jamie.
Perfect. So I was born in 1978 in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. So my father and mother were dated and got married when they were in university on the east coast of Canada in the province of Ontario. My father was a geologist, so we moved to Calgary, where the oil industry is. And so I didn't grow up in Calgary. I was born there, lived there for a few years. My father worked on the oil rigs in northern Alberta and Northwest Territories, and then took a government opportunity with the National Energy Board, and we moved back to the capital of Canada, Ottawa, Canada. And I grew up most of my life there, but I grew up 30, 45 minutes south of the city, in kind of farm country, really like exoburbs all the way to kind of farm country. So I grew up a very picturesque lifestyle, right? So I grew up on the Rideau River. So every day I would come home from school, I would go fishing. It was part of my backyard. Or in the winter, I played hockey with my brother out on the rink every single day. And did my undergrad at the University of Ottawa, and I am a C student at best, which is ironic now owning an education company. So I was a C student at best, but I was an A plus student at chugging beer, and worked also at the Bank of Montreal while doing my university degree. So I finished university with 2 or 3 years worth of working experience. And I had an opportunity to go do my master's degree. And I left to Adelaide, Australia. And I lived in Adelaide, Australia for 2 years at the University of South Australia. Played rugby for the university. I did my 2 years of MBA school there. And I really had never been to Toronto, Canada, which, you know, it's about 500 kilometers from Ottawa. But that's, people from Ottawa would go to Montreal rather than going to Toronto. And had an opportunity to move to Toronto, which is where basically most businesses set up shop in Canada.
Yeah.
And so in 2004, moved to Toronto and got my very first sales job. And the rest, you know, kind of is history from there.
Wow. So what made you decide to go to Australia from Canada? Was it the weather?
No, it was. So I was working on the stock exchange in 2000, watching people make all kinds of money. Mm-hmm. And then in 2000, watching people lose their life savings. And I got really disenfranchised with being a stockbroker. I wanted to be a stockbroker my whole life. I did my grade nine job shadow day as a stockbroker. I did my university volunteering as a stockbroker. I was convinced I wanted to be a stockbroker. What I didn't realize, and this is the ironic part, I thought stockbrokers picked the stocks. Mm. I didn't realize that stockbrokers were, in fact, sales professionals selling stocks many times that were underwritten by the very banks that they work at. And so when I watched brokers make trades for people who were retired government employees, and they were buying high velocity tech companies for them, and then watching their fortunes dwindle, I lost interest in the industry. Mm. And I had a friend call me one day, and he said, "Hey, do you want to go do your MBA?" I said, "I'll do anything to get out of here." And coming from a Commonwealth country, we started to look around at London, Ireland, Scotland, South Africa, common countries, because it was easy for immigration.
Yeah.
And Australia came up.
Wow. And well, that must have been a bit of a culture shock or not.
It's really not. So the joke that we used to say about Adelaide, Australia, it was like Canada circa 1983. So it had all the it was very laid back, and from a technology standpoint, it was like doing a bit of a time warp. Mm. In some respects. So it felt like you were going back to the ease and comfort of your childhood, where life was more simple.
Yes.
That's what I liked about it. Now, of course, Australia's expanded. Sydney and Melbourne are completely different places now. But, Adelaide, Australia was a dusty little town at the time. And it felt like I was reliving my childhood again.
Wow. What a great experience. And how many years were you out there for?
For 2 years.
Oh, wow. And did you want to come back to Canada or stay out there?
I was looking to apply for my permanent residency in Sydney.
Yeah.
And I had a friend here in Toronto who had rented a home in the most affluent neighborhood in Toronto, and realized, I can't afford this place. I need roommates.
Yes.
And he called me and he said, would you be willing to move back to Canada? I said, wow, I don't have a job here.
Right.
So, might as well just do it.
Oh, wow.
And then I never left.
Oh, my God. And have you been back to Australia since?
Yeah, for work a few times.
Oh, great.
We train around the world, so it's brought us to Sydney quite a few times.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. And, of course, you have something in common then if you're out there and you say, right, I went to university here and...
Yeah. Oh, I know the language. I know the language. I know the beers.
Oh, brilliant! That's brilliant. I love that story. That's just amazing. So, how did you find your first job then? So you moved back and then went.
So I was a transient bum for about 10 months. Because I was like a tweener, and what I mean by a tweener is, I didn't have enough sales experience where somebody really was interested in my resume, but I had just enough education and experience that I was going to be paid a little bit extra, right?
Yeah.
So I was that tweener that from a sales perspective, there were companies that just didn't want to take a punt on me. And it turned out that 10, 11 months in, I'm borrowing money from my parents just to pay rent. And it was a bit of a mess. And there was a corporate real estate company that I had interviewed at a whole bunch of times. And they just kept turning me down. Well, I got frustrated a couple of days before my birthday. My birthday is Halloween, October. It's October 30th. So Halloween in North America, October 31.
Yeah.
And so a couple of days before my birthday, I said, I can't take this anymore. I'm going to be, at that time, 25 years old. I put on a suit. I walked into the office of this corporate real estate firm, and I waited until the receptionist left her post. And I snuck into the building and went into the president's office.
Yeah.
And as I was going into the president's office to kind of confront him and say, please give me a job, he was walking out of his own office with a squash bag going to a racket club.
Mm.
And he turned to me and he said, who are you? And I got really frustrated because I had interviewed with this guy for, you know, six times.
Oh, my God.
And so I, like a puppy dog, I followed him for, you know, 10 blocks to the squash club and just begged him the whole way. Give me a job. Give me a job. Give me a job. And they finally did. And you know, the rest is history.
Oh, my God. Yeah. What compelled you to do that?
I needed money really bad.
You needed money.
You know, I have other stories like that. When, you know, I'm a believer that there's certain types of people, that those that will just do what it takes to get it done.
Yes.
And it's because, and I think it's a little bit of my upbringing. I grew up where I worked on farms. I grew up where I tree planted. I did all the terrible jobs in my youth. So it gave me the experience to realize, if you just need to get it done, you just need to get it done.
Yeah. Wow. That's great. That, and okay, so that, so you ended up with this real estate organization.
Yeah.
And what, doing sales or?
Yeah. So the way it works in corporate real estate, also known as commercial real estate, is you are your own agent. You're basically an intrapreneur. You know, it's a 50% commission. 50 goes to the house, 50 goes to you.
Yeah.
As like a desk fee. And you have to find your own customers, win the account, do the transaction of the real estate transaction, and then help them with the implementation of, you know, the migration of office space A to office space B. And the company was founded by an ex-Xerox president. And so the culture of this company, of this corporate real estate company, was heavily influenced by sales methodology. I mean, there was an extensive amount of sales training because that's where the founder came from.
Yeah.
And so it gave me incredible fundamentals around phone and email conversations, discovery calls, proposals, and so forth. I got my MBA in sales in quick order at this commercial real estate company.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
So that was a great kind of training for you.
It was incredible. And you know, the industry is very difficult. And so it had high levels of churn.
Yeah.
And it's produced so many great sales leaders in the Toronto area, because it's a training ground of education, you know, on best practices.
Yeah. And it's pretty tough as well, I would imagine. So
it is. The toughest part is time management in that space, because you're now a full stack seller.
Yeah.
You're moving all the way from your own prospecting all the way to nurturing an existing customer is a lot of work. And those that fail are those that can't time manage properly.
Yeah. Wow. So, okay. So how long did you stay there and what was the next step?
I was there for 2 years and I'm then 27 years old, and there were some bright, shiny objects put in front of my face. So it was a customer. I was helping them with their office space, and the customer turned to me and he said, I'm looking for a director of sales, and this is Captive Channel. Would you be willing to come on board? And I said, well, no, I love what I do. And he said, well, would you take six figures? I said, yep. Yeah. So for six figures, I will. And so I jumped ship there, and it was a good learning experience. This was a field sales role. I was traveling all across Canada.
Yeah.
And we were evangelizing. It was like bleeding edge. What it was if you've ever been in the tube system in London or in North America, you've got TV screens now in elevators and in grocery stores. But, you know, 10, 15 years ago, that was not very common. Well, they were playing commercials and news wires on these TV screens.
Okay.
And so it was an advertising and a hardware company put together.
Right.
And so I was there for 2 years. And what I realized was I kept finding myself writing business plans. My entrepreneurial gene sort of kicking in there. And I I was always trying to find ways to leave. Mm. And from there, I did end up leaving after 2 years, and I founded Canada's very first zero emissions landscaping company. And so it was all lithium ion battery powered. This is 10 years ago.
Wow.
Driven around by smart cars. And it was highly successful from a sales standpoint. We did $300,000 in our first year, but my partner, it was just a partnership implosion. And I ended up selling my shares at a loss. The partnership dissolved,
yeah.
But I got to whet my appetite with entrepreneurship, and I needed a job pretty bad. So there was an opportunity to be the third employed at a SaaS software company in Toronto that liked my entrepreneurial experience. And so I came in as the third employee, and we grew a sales force at a company called Firmex.
Right.
But the whole time I was there as well, my entrepreneurial gene kept firing up, kind of thing.
Oh, so you were... You kept thinking about what can I do for myself, right?
Yeah. And it is because, it was my teenage years, I worked as a farm kid or I ran landscaping companies.
Mm.
And then when you work in the stock brokerage industry, you are an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And you're an entrepreneur. And then you go to commercial real estate and you're an entrepreneur again. And so you really never work for anyone. And then once I started actually being an employee, I realized it wasn't for me. And so by 2009, I'm at that time now 30, 31, I decided to leave and start a consulting firm to help other, at the time, it was to help small businesses in the Toronto region learning inside sales, cold calling, best practices, these sort of things.
Yes. So this was your own company then?
This was So Sales for Life, this is not Sales for Life. I started kind of my own hang a shingle consulting firm in January 1st, 2010.
Okay. So this was you on your own consultancy, kind of, teaching people everything that you'd learned from literally from the farm, through to all the sales jobs you got and then sharing that knowledge and information. So how did you do that? I mean, what made you find you were good by now writing business plans, but what about the content? How did you create the content and the information for it?
This was a bit of a giant failure. So what I had, what I had discovered was a couple of things.
Yes.
One, being a generalist service provider is a recipe of disaster. Whether it's marketing agencies or training companies or any service-based industry, if you are a generalist, if somebody can go to your website and you do 15 different things, but you're not known for that one thing, you will die the death of a thousand paper cuts.
Yeah.
And that was part of the failure. The second part of the failure was I would win an engagement or two, and I would spend every waking hour trying to make sure that engagement was successful. But what it did was it sacrificed business development for my own business.
Yes.
And so I wasn't building a sustainable pipeline. And so fast forward 18 months later, I was nearly bankrupt because, I had had only a few customers that were taking up an extraordinary amount of time, and I wasn't able to build a pipeline of other accounts to be able to service. I was essentially, it felt like I was a contractor into other people's businesses,
yes,
not building an actual sustainable company.
Mm. Wow. So yeah. The thing is, there's no such thing as failure, right? There's only feedback. And you got a lot of feedback about what you did wrong in that process, which obviously you take forward to your next project. And did you go back into employment, or what did you do?
No. Well, okay. This is a story that's told in the preface of my book. Is basically I had a giant slap in the face, wake up call. And that wake up call was in early 2011. I'm a failing business, and it's days before my wedding. And I go into the office of one of my few remaining customers, and there's a federal police officer in that office. And the company that I was working with got caught with fraud and embezzlement.
Oh, no.
And they owed me $35,000, which at the time was all the money in the world to me. And if anybody here on the, you know, as a listener has ever been what's known as an unsecured vendor, you're very low on the totem pole of creditors, right?
Of
the banks get paid first, then the employees, and then the lonesome, you know, unsecured vendors. And so I wasn't going to get paid. I'm just about to go get married. And so we're on our flight to Costa Rica with my soon to be wife. And I have to break her the news that, by the way, when we get home, we have no money. I have no job. What a husband I am.
Oh,
and what a catch. And so the second half of that story, and there's other funny pieces to it, but to kind of fast forward, the second half of it is when we got back to Canada, I had to let go. I had then had employees. I had to let go of the employees. I had to start from scratch. And what had happened at that time was I'm sick to my stomach. I can't eat. I can't sleep. And I'd be in our spare bedroom at, you know, 2-3 in the morning every night, just head in hand, trying to figure out, where did I go wrong and how do I fix these mistakes that I made? And basically what I discovered was that I would just stare at my computer, and for whatever reason, I would stare at a tool called LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And in 2011, there were no online courses on social selling. The word social selling hadn't even been invented yet.
No.
So it was, you know, at the time people were just calling it social media for sales. And I would just look at LinkedIn and I'd think to myself, listen, I was great on the phone. I was great with email. How could I communicate with a VP of sales or a president of a business in the Toronto region faster? Because I can't make 50 or 100 dials a day anymore because I'm now engaged at customers' offices during the day. What can I do? And I would discover these backdoors, these hacks, these best practices, self-discovered on LinkedIn. And then the next day I would go into the office of one of my few remaining customers and I would show them these tips that I'd learned, and they loved it. And they were far more interested in these new services or ideas than my traditional, you know, out of the box solutions. And then the light bulb went off and I went, oh my God, like I now realize where service businesses fail is I was offering a hodgepodge of services that had really no market differentiation from other people. But now I was approaching this service where it was like I had shown them fire for the very first time. I'd shown my peers, my sales professionals, fire. And they went, give me more. Like, I need more of this. And that's where Sales for Life was born.
Wow. And this was to begin with you on your own, right?
So I discovered these tips on my own. And around that same time, I was trying to pitch a customer. And in North America, they're known as Grainger. And I was trying to pitch them on this idea that I, as a consultant, you ask me to help re-engineer your inside sales team. But one of the biggest problems with it was that you're not having me hire the very people that I'm trying to engineer. Why don't you give me a recruiting fee? I'll find you the talent and I'll do the consultancy. Well, it turns out that the live meeting 1 hour before me was this gentleman named George Albert, who had been a customer of Grainger for years, who was their recruiter. But he kept saying to the team, listen, you have me place all this talent, yet you do a terrible job of onboarding and making them successful. Thus, they churn out. Thus, in a recruiting fee, I have to rebate you when they don't last.
Mm.
What if I come in and consult? So the customer then stopped me dead in the meeting and he said, listen, I just heard this story an hour ago, except it was the opposite. Why don't I take the two of you out for lunch and introduce you? So we went to lunch, introduced George Albert and I, and the customer said, listen, George, your business is worth nothing. He was the sole owner of Sales for Life. Jamie, your consultancy is worth nothing. So why don't the two of you merge and build something better?
Wow.
And that's what we did. And at the time, we had, you know, there was a hodgepodge of services, but I said to George, there is this new thing I've discovered and doesn't have a name yet, but these tools like LinkedIn and Twitter, I can book a meeting with the president of a company in minutes, which would take me half a year to get into this account. And so that's kind of the genesis of merging together and deciding to abandon all the other services that are already generating revenue to take a flyer on this concept now called social selling. And the goal is it had to be extremely scalable. We've learned from our, here's the learnings from the mistakes. It had to be extremely scalable at a global level. And number two, it had to be able to create recurring revenue. And number three, we had to be the very best in the world. We could be able to design something where you could become the undisputed category king.
Wow. I love it. What a great story. And, you know, the thing is, it's somehow serendipity happened with that client. And you obviously found your new partner, George. What's his surname?
George Albert.
Albert.
And I agree with you on, and I think, sorry to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that the times that our business has accelerated the most is after a major failure. We'll lose, I'll give an example, Halloween this year, 2016, we lost $165,000 engagement. Because that company that night on the end of our Q1 got a hostile takeover on the stock exchange. And so that customer no longer exists. But that taught us around a greater balance of account segmentation. We had too much weight weighing in on global enterprise accounts. And so we, unlike most services businesses, are also moving downstream. Like we're actually trying to take on smaller accounts to be able to diversify the, you know, the cash flow of the business.
Sure.
Whereas most services companies are dreaming of going upstream.
Yeah.
We actually have the inverse challenge. But anyways, the point of the story is every time we have a massive challenge, I find that those corrections that you make are typically the best ones in the business.
And while it's true what they say, and this is a great lesson for all our listeners who are aspiring business owners, but indeed also current business owners looking to scale their business and grow their business. And so really, really grateful for you sharing that information. That we're always learning. I call some of those, you know, bigger lessons, I call them gifts. You don't know what the gift is when it happens. It's not great. It's not enjoyable when you're in the middle of it all. But actually, over time, eventually you realize that having gone through it, it was a gift. You come out the other side. You're wiser. You've learned something from it. You may change your strategy as a result of it. And that's why the gift showed up, you know. So, well, you've been sharing some amazing challenges. What I'd like you to also share with running Sales for Life, what have been some of the highlights for you?
Well, the highlights are 5 years later from the date of inception, we've become a multi-million dollar business that trains globally around the world, 300 global customers. And our customer base is the who's who of the tech and the telecom space, from, you know, AT&T and Sprint on the on the telecom side. And then on the technology side, it's the Microsoft, Oracle, Intel, Thomson Reuters of the world. So we've been blessed with winning great accounts because we put in the hard work to build a scalable. What's made us successful is we've combined scale with white glove service to deploy education. And it's known as blended learning. So you have virtual instructor-led training intermixed with virtual coaching and e-learning that allows us from the Toronto region to train in Japan and Germany and Latin America from one location. But the white glove services that we deploy, excellent customer success managers who every single day are with the customer handholding. So we provide a lot of human contextualization, a lot of human touch intermixed with, you know, the scale piece of it. But some of the best things from a business owner standpoint that we've done is one of the very first things to kickstart the business. It was one of the single smartest things we ever did. When George and I decided we wanted to get into this thing called social selling, you know, this was a bit of a flyer. So we agreed that what we would do is that we would identify 10 companies in the Toronto region and we would train them for free. And we would train them for free in exchange for incredible references and testimonials. And it was by agreement that the customer, even if one of their competitors called for a reference, they would have to give us glowing reviews, assuming that the training was good.
Yeah.
And what it did was it landed us in a 90-day period, 10 accounts. And those 10 accounts, we could reverse engineer, which is part of our curriculum known as the sphere of influence, all the past employees that used to work at that company. Where did they migrate to? Who are all their vendors and partners? Who are all their competitors? And we just approached those companies. So one of our very first customers that we won was a telecom company called Level 3 Communications. From Level 3 Communications, we won XO Communications, Tata Communications. And it started to spiderweb because you had your original great story.
Yeah.
And as an entrepreneur, if you're trying to start a business, revenue is critical. You can only imagine. Yes, of course, revenue is critical. But having a customer base that future buyers can look at and say, yeah, I'll buy because of them. Like right now, we attract global enterprise companies because all they have to do is go to the website and they realize that four of their competitors have already been through training.
Yeah.
That's compelling. But if you don't have those customer stories, clients aren't willing to take a chance.
That's right. Yeah. Because it gives you credibility. It gives you, you know, what they call now social proof. And
exactly. And
it allows them to build trust in you before they even engage you. So that's why it works. And that's why it's very, very powerful. So, wow, yeah. That's absolutely amazing. So inevitably, the next question for me is, you as an ex-stockbroker and being in the stock market, do you have a vision to float your business and go public?
You know, I don't know that I do. I haven't thought of it. You know, sometimes maybe it's my conservative Canadian mind, but sometimes I don't know that I struggle to think that big. And I'm always envious when I'm hanging out with my American peers who they just think at a 10x level that just blows my mind. For us, my mission, and I have my why written as the headline in my LinkedIn profile, is that I want to train over 1 million sales professionals around the globe. I want to give back and empower more than 1 million sales professionals around the globe to move them from an analog way of selling to a digital way of selling. And by doing that, you know, all great things will come, you know, as you can imagine with scaling and training 1 million sales professionals. We're near 100,000 now. But so I have 10x to go.
Yeah,
where we can deploy education that moves the needle for thousands and thousands and thousands of companies, and that's kind of what motivates me.
Wow, it's a great mission to have, and you know it's very clear what your mission is. I mean, everybody can sign up to that. Everybody can, you know, respect that, and also help you with that too, you know.
I agree.
Because it attracts people by saying, oh, that's your mission, I'm going to help you with that, right? Let me find some more salespeople for you. Because if you articulate it so clearly, then everybody can understand it. It's simple. Brilliant. Okay, so now all these aspiring and existing business owners that are listening to this podcast, if there was one bit of advice you would give these aspiring business owners or existing business owners, what advice would that be, Jamie?
Scale your go-to-market strategy through education and content. That would be my the second pillar that made us successful. Is from day one, we realized that the buyer's journey is going to require many pieces of that buying journey is going to happen with or without us. The buyer is going to do online due diligence. The buyer is going to want to self-educate. And so what we did is facilitated that process. We write a blog a day. We do a webinar a week. We are part of podcasts and video series, and we create infographics and case studies. It just an endless amount of education we put in the market. And what that does, it creates a lead magnet. Our business, 40% of all of our revenue comes inbound. The rest is a mixture of other lead sources, whether that's channel, customer referral, customer expansion, account-based sales development, all the other goodies. But think of that tap. 40% is going to come, for us currently, comes inbound through the demand gen waterfall, and that is driven primarily by organic content, original content development. We're turning up the taps on paid media, but what, you know, our real bread and butter is put out education and have people come sweeping in through the demand gen waterfall.
That's a very, very big number. So well done to you guys. Awesome stuff. And the really, really interesting thing about that, even though if you're able to sustain that level of inbound, that the amount of noise that is happening on social media is really, really big nowadays. You know, there's so many people posting content and doing stuff. But the difference, I believe, of what you're doing, because I think your advice is really sound, is what you said for me was the magic thing, which was we produce an article every day. You know, we do a webinar every week, and you have that consistency. And that's what I'm hearing in what you're saying, is having a consistent approach that almost people are expecting it to see it, and they're getting used to it, and they're getting comfortable with it, and they're trusting it. Because I see so much of what people do is inconsistent and not regular.
Correct. It's there is definitely a... there's mathematical formulas. If you do this long enough, you'll realize that there's mathematics between quantity and then the quality. So for us, that we've got the quantity down pat. We're even dispersing out extra blogs, as we call it, Operation Land Grab, where you're giving your blogs to other people and they're posting them on their sites and it's driving traffic back to you.
Yes.
So from a volume standpoint, we've got that down pat. Where we're now changing gears is to become journalists. So improve the quality. So doing original thought leadership. Original insights. So original data.
Yeah.
Where you are doing the research yourself. And so we're converting to more of a journalistic approach rather than top 10 lists and
yes
and all those kind of things.
Got you. Yeah. And because, I mean, you know, whatever we might think about robots and AI and all of that good stuff that's coming down the line, which will be churning out more and more stuff, you're absolutely right. To step up the level of, you know, information and, you know, make it more interesting to people, because, you know, you've got to somehow find a way to stand out of the crowd. Because so many people now are doing the, you know, top 7 reasons, 10, you know, 10 tips here and everything. So
yeah, and they're getting caught up in the volume. They're getting caught up to where the market was. So they didn't have a baseline of digital content marketing. So now they're getting into the 1.0 stage. We're moving into the 2.0 stage,
yeah,
which is around podcasts, as an example, are reemerging as an incredible medium. Video series, but then official journalism, where people are reading your content because they are collecting data to make informed decisions.
Yes. Wow. I could speak to you or with you or listen to you for hours more, and we haven't got hours. So thank you so much. I've learned a huge amount, and I know our listeners will have learned so much from you. Thank you so much. And I've got one last question to end with, and it is, how can people get in touch with you? Where can they locate and engage with you and get some of that great inbound stuff that you're delivering?
Perfect. So, again, my name is Jamie Shanks. I'm the CEO of Sales for Life. You can reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. And our website is pretty simple, salesforlife.com. And happy to help any way that we can to help you along your sales and marketing journey, moving from analog to digital.
Brilliant, Jamie. Thank you so much for joining me today. And one day, hopefully, let me know if you come this way to the United Kingdom, to London, to do any of your training. And let's meet up and have some lunch together, because I'd love to talk a bunch more with you as well.
Thank you so much.
Take care and all the best.
Thank you. You take care.
Bye.
Staying Alive UK. Share your story.